dropped it out and sent it in. We, Chevalier and Oppenheimer, both were and were not members of the Communist Party, any way you want to look at it. Hoken Chevalier. On September 20th, 1937, Julius Oppenheimer died of a heart attack at the age of 67. Robert had known that his father was no longer robust, but his sudden death came as a shock. In the nearly 6 years since Ella's death in 1931, Julius had developed a close and tender relationship with his sons. He visited them both frequently, and it was often the case that Robert's friends became his father's friends. Julius's fortune had diminished somewhat after 8 years of depression. Even so, by the time of his death, his estate, divided equally between Robert and Frank, amounted to the still quite substantial sum of $392,602. The annual income from this inheritance gave each of the brothers an average of $10,000 to supplement his earnings. But, as if to underscore a certain ambivalence about his wealth, Robert immediately wrote out a will leaving his entire estate to the University of California, earmarked for graduate fellowships. The Oppenheimer brothers had always been extremely close. Robert formed remarkably intense relationships with a number of people, but none was either as deep or as durable as the bond he forged with his brother. Their correspondence in the 1930s reflected an intensity of emotion unusual for siblings, and particularly so for brothers 8 years apart in age. Robert's letters often read more like a father's than an older brother's. At times, he wrote with what must have seemed a maddening condescension to Frank, who so obviously wished to emulate him. Frank patiently tolerated whatever his strong-willed brother said or did. Only years later did he admit that Robert's youthful cockiness stayed with my brother a little longer than it should have. They were alike, and yet not. No one disliked Frank Oppenheimer. He was Oppie without an edge, endowed with much of the Oppenheimer brilliance and none of the abrasiveness. Frank himself is a sweet, lovable person, observed the physicist Leona Marshall Libby, a friend of both brothers. She called him a delta function, a mathematical device used by physicists in which delta is defined as zero, except at a specified place or time, at which point it becomes infinity. When called upon, Frank always possessed an infinite reservoir of goodwill and cheer. Years later, Robert himself said of his brother, "He is a much finer person than I am." At one time, Robert had tried to talk Frank out of choosing physics as his profession. When Frank was only 13 and clearly set on following in his brother's footsteps, Robert wrote, "I don't think you would enjoy reading about relativity very much until you have studied a little geometry, a little mechanics, a little electrodynamics. But if you want to try, Eddington's book is the best to start on. And now, a final word of advice. Try to understand really, to your own satisfaction, thoroughly and honestly, the few things in which you are most interested. Because it is only when you have learnt to do that, when you realize how hard and how very satisfying it is, that you will appreciate fully the more spectacular things like relativity and mechanistic biology. If you think I'm wrong, please don't hesitate to tell me so. I'm only talking from my own very small experience." By the time he got to Baltimore and Johns Hopkins University, Frank was determined to demonstrate that he was made of the same stuff as his brother. Like Robert, he was a polymath. He loved music, and unlike his brother, he actually played an instrument, the flute, extremely well. At Hopkins, he regularly played in a quartet. But he was committed to physics. During his second year, Frank met Robert in New Orleans, where they attended the annual meeting of the American Physical Society. Afterwards, Robert wrote Ernest Lawrence that, "We had a fine holiday together, and I think that it settled definitely Frank's vocation for physics." After rubbing shoulders with a good number of physicists, all of them bubbling over with enthusiasm for their work, Robert observed that it is impossible not to conceive for them a great liking and respect, and for their work a great attraction. On the second day of the conference, Robert took Frank to a joint session on biochemistry and psychology, and, while it was enormously rowdy and very funny, it also discouraged an excessive faith in either of these sciences. But then, only a few months later, Robert cautioned Frank not to commit himself to physics without first exploring the alternatives. He thought Frank's intellectual appetite might be whetted by some coursework in the biological sciences. While declaring that, "I know very well, surely, that physics has a beauty which no other science can match, a rigor and austerity and depth," he urged Frank to take an advanced course in physiology. Genetics certainly involves a rigorous technique and a constructive and complicated theory. By all means, and with my whole blessing, learn physics, all there is of it, so that you understand it and can use it and contemplate it and, if you should want, teach it. But do not plan yet to do it, to adopt physical research as a vocation. For that decision, you should know something more of the other sciences and a good deal more of physics. Frank ignored this bit of sibling counsel. After earning his undergraduate degree in physics in only 3 years, he spent 1933-35 studying at Cavendish Laboratory in England under some of the same physicists who had taught Robert, and he met such friends of his brothers as Paul Dirac and Max Born. By then, however, Robert was more than reconciled to his brother's chosen course. "You know how happy I was," he wrote Frank in 1933, "with your decision to go to Cambridge." But now he longed to see his brother. "There has seldom been a time," he wrote Frank in early 1934, "when I have missed you so as in these last days. I take it that Cambridge has been right for you and that physics has gotten now very much under your skin, physics and the obvious excellences of the life it brings. I take it that you've been working very hard, getting your hand in the laboratory and learning mathematics at close hand, and finding in this, and in the natural austerity of life in Cambridge, at last an adequate field for your unremitting need of discipline and order." If at times Robert sounded patronizing in his role as elder brother, his letters to Frank make it clear that he was as dependent on the closeness of his brotherly bond as was Frank. Unlike Robert, Frank excelled at experimental physics. He liked getting his hands dirty in the laboratory. He loved tinkering with machines and once built his brother a custom phonograph. As Robert observed, Frank had a way of reducing a specific and rather complex situation to its central, irreducible Fragestellung, formulation of a question. After studying 2 years in England and several months in Italy, where he observed and acquired a loathing for Mussolini's fascism, Frank applied to several universities to complete his PhD in experimental physics. He was conflicted about whether to go to Caltech, but Robert did something, and suddenly Caltech offered him a tuition scholarship based on merit, and his decision was made. In the laboratory, he worked under Robert's old friend, Charlie Lauritsen, experimenting with a beta-ray spectrograph. Whereas Robert had taken only 2 years to complete his doctorate, Frank spent a leisurely 4 earning his. In part, this was because experimental work was often simply more time-consuming than theoretical physics. But it was also Frank's choice, by temperament and inclination, to fill his life with more than physics. He loved music and was accomplished enough as a flautist that his brother and many friends thought he could have played professionally. Drawing on his mother's artistic sensibilities, he loved painting and read a great deal of poetry. In contrast to Robert's assiduously correct European manners, friends thought Frank rather sloppy in dress and bohemian in manner. During his first year at Caltech, Frank met Jacquinette Jackie Kwan, a 24-year-old French-Canadian woman who was studying economics at Berkeley. They met in Berkeley in the spring of 1936 when Robert took his brother to visit a friend, Winona Nedelsky, and Jackie happened to be there babysitting. To pay the bills, she worked as a waitress. Plain and outspoken, she possessed a down-to-earth demeanor that rebuffed pretentiousness. "Jackie prided herself on being working class," said Bob Serber, "and she had no use for intellectuals. Her ambition was to be a social worker. She wore her hair in a simple pageboy cut and never bothered with lipstick or other makeup. She was not the kind of woman Robert Oppenheimer would have chosen for his brother. But later that spring, Robert, Frank, Jackie, and Winona, recently separated from her husband Leo, went out together 2 or 3 times. In June, Frank invited Jackie to come up to Perro Caliente that summer. They arrived in a brand new $750 Ford pickup truck, a gift from Robert. When, later that summer, Frank informed Robert that he intended to marry Jackie, Robert tried to talk him out of it. Jackie and Robert did not get along. She recalled that he was always saying things like, "Of course, you're much older than Frank. I'm 8 months older, actually," and saying that Frank wasn't ready for it. This time, however, Frank ignored his brother's advice and married Jackie on September 15, 1936. "It was an act of emancipation and rebellion on his part," wrote Robert, "against his dependence on me." Robert continued to disparage Jackie by referring to her as the waitress my brother has married. On the other hand, he continued to arrange things for his brother and his new wife. "The three of us saw each other a great deal in Pasadena, Berkeley, and Perro Caliente," recalled Frank, "and between my brother and me there was the continuing sharing of ideas, enterprises, and friends." Jackie had always been a political firebrand. "She could drive you crazy with her political rants," recalled a relative. As an undergraduate at Berkeley, she had joined the Young Communist League, and later she worked for a year in Los Angeles for the Communist Party newspaper. Frank was quite comfortable with her politics. "I had been close to sort of slightly left-wing things starting in high school," he recalled. "I remember once I went with some friends to hear a concert at Carnegie Hall that didn't have a conductor. It was a kind of down-with-the-bosses movement." Like Robert, Frank was a product of the ethical culture school, where he had learned to debate moral and ethical issues. At 16, he had worked, together with some of his school friends, on Al Smith's 1928 presidential campaign. At Johns Hopkins, many of his peers were to the left of the Democratic Party. But at the time, Frank disliked long-winded political discussions. "I used to tell people," he recalled, "unless I meant to do something about it, I didn't want to talk about it." He recalled being dismayed in 1935 by what he heard at a Communist Party meeting in Cambridge, England. "It sounded to me sort of empty," Frank recalled. During a visit to Germany, however, he quickly acquired an appreciation of the fascist menace. The whole society seemed corrupt. His father's relatives had told him some of the terrible things that were happening in Hitler's Germany, and he was inclined to support any group determined to do something about it. Upon his return to California that autumn, he was deeply moved by the deplorable condition of local farm laborers and Negroes. The Depression was taking a terrible toll on millions of people. Another graduate student in physics at Caltech, William Willie Fowler, used to say that the reason he was a physicist was that he didn't want to have to worry about people, and now he was upset because he was being forced by the Depression to do just that. Frank felt the same way. He began reading up on labor history and eventually read a great deal of Marx, Engels, and Lenin. One day, early in 1937, Jackie and Frank saw a membership coupon in the local communist newspaper, People's World. "I clipped it out and sent it in," recalled Frank. "We were really quite overt about it, completely overt about it." But it was some months before anybody from the party responded. Like many professionals, Frank was asked to join the party under an alias, and he chose the name Frank Folsom. "When I joined the Communist Party," he later testified, "for some reason which I did not understand at the time and have never understood since, they requested that my right name and another name be written down. This seemed to me ludicrous. I never used any name but my own. And at the same time, because of the fact that it seems so ludicrous, I wrote down the name of a California jail, Folsom." In 1937, his Communist Party book number was 56385. One day he absentmindedly left his green-colored party card in his shirt pocket when sending it to the laundry. The shirt came back with the party card neatly preserved in an envelope. By 1935, it was not at all unusual for Americans who were concerned with economic justice, including many New Deal liberals, to identify with the communist movement. Many laborers, as well as writers, journalists, and teachers, supported the most radical features of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And even if most intellectuals didn't actually join the Communist Party, their hearts lay with a populist movement that promised a just world steeped in a culture of egalitarianism. Frank's attachment to communism had deep American roots. As he later explained, "The intellectuals who were drawn toward the left by the horror, the injustices, and fears of the 30s did, in varying degrees, identify with the history of protest in America. John Brown, Susan B. Anthony, Clarence Darrow, Jack London, and even with movements such as the abolitionists, the early AFL, and the IWW. Initially, the party assigned Frank and Jackie to what was called a street unit in Pasadena. Most of their comrades were local neighborhood residents, and quite a few were poor, unemployed Negroes. Their party cell membership fluctuated between 10 and as many as 30 people. They had regular open meetings attended by both communists and members of various organizations connected with the New Deal, such as the Workers' Alliance, an organization of unemployed laborers. There was a lot of talk and not much action, which frustrated Frank. "We tried to integrate the city swimming pool," he said. "They just allowed blacks in Wednesday afternoon and evening, and then they drained the pool Thursday morning." but despite their efforts, the pool remained segregated. A little later, Frank agreed to try to organize a party unit at Caltech. Jackie remained with the street unit for a while, but she too eventually joined the Caltech group. She and Frank recruited about 10 members, including fellow graduate students Frank K. Molina, Sidney Weinbaum, and Sui Shun Tsien. Unlike the Pasadena street unit, this Caltech group was essentially a secret group. Frank was the only member who remained open about his political affiliation. Most of the others, he explained, were scared of losing their jobs. Frank understood that his association with the party offended some people. "I remember a friend of my father's, an old man, saying he wouldn't send his son to a college at which I was teaching." The Stanford physicist Felix Bloch once tried to persuade him to quit the party, but Frank wouldn't hear of it. Most of his friends, however, cared little one way or the other. Party membership was just one aspect of his life. By then, Frank was devoted to his studies in beta-ray spectroscopy at Caltech. Like his brother, he stood on the edge of a promising career. But his politics, if not necessarily his party membership, were both an open book and an extracurricular activity. One day, Ernest Lawrence ran into Frank, whom he liked very much, and asked him why he wasted so much time with causes. It baffled Lawrence, who saw himself as a man of science above politics, even though he spent much of his own time ingratiating himself with the businessmen and financiers on the Board of Regents who directed the policies of the University of California. In his own way, Lawrence was as much of a political animal as Frank. He just owed his allegiance to different causes. Frank and Jackie opened their home to regular Tuesday evening CP meetings. According to one reliable confidential FBI informant, Frank continued to host these meetings until about June 1941. Robert attended at least once, which he later claimed was the only time he participated in a recognizable Communist Party meeting. The topic was the ongoing concern of racial segregation at Pasadena's municipal swimming pool. Robert later testified that the meeting made a rather pathetic impression on me. Like his brother, Frank was active in the East Bay Teachers Union, the Consumers Union, and the cause of migratory farm workers in California. One evening, he gave a flute recital in Pasadena with Ruth Tolman on the piano in a local auditorium. Proceeds from the event went to the Spanish Republic. "We spent a lot of time at meetings, political meetings," Frank later said. "There were many issues." "He frequently spoke," a Stanford colleague told the FBI, "of instances of economic oppression which he seemed to resent." Another informant claimed that Frank continually showed a great admiration for the Soviet Union in its internal and external policies. On occasion, Frank could be strident. He assailed one colleague, who reported the conversation to the FBI later, as a hopeless bourgeois not in sympathy with the proletariat. Robert later made light of his brother's communist associations. Although a party member, Frank did a lot of other things. He was passionately fond of music. He had many wholly non-communist friends. He spent his summers at the ranch. He couldn't have been, Robert summed up, a very hard-working communist during those years.